As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
We are live again. Welcome in, everybody. Another live room. This one after the conclusion of the 49ers offseason program. Another early conclusion, at least based on the original schedule, but this is customary for the 49ers. Kyle Shanahan is happy with the work that has been done. Then he lets everybody go home for the summer about a week early. So, Matt, we got to see several practices, a lot of talk about the quarterbacks, but I think this entire 49ers roster is really exciting. So it's one of those things where we could sit down afterward and we could probably sit here for 5 hours talking. We're not going to do that to people. We're not going to do that to ourselves. But there is a whole lot to unpack about this 49ers team entering this long 7-week offseason.
Yeah, for sure. Quarterbacks are always topic A. But I thought that the rookie class was interesting. It seems like, you know, despite the fact that they didn't pick until the end of the third round, they got a lot of bright guys. So that was clear when we talked to them, and I think that was clear with what we were seeing on the field. Only Jair Brown got any sort of reps with the ones, but a lot of those rookies, a lot of the draft picks were working with the second team group, and you couldn't tell that they were rookies out there. They were moving around quickly. They were fast. I would say that it was a successful first step for that entire group, including Jake Moody, who really kind of ended the spring session with a bang, kicking a 63-yarder. A day after he looked kind of wobbly out there, he calmly put in all five of his attempts, including a really, really long one towards the end. So that seems to be going as planned so far.
Yeah, the Jake Moody thing is fun to watch because he's just got such an electric leg, a booming leg, I guess would be the better word to put there. And we suspected he did based on the resume from college, but until you actually see it up close and in person, it's, you know, you don't really fully appreciate it. And the 49ers had a really, really good kicker in the past several seasons in Robbie Gould. But he didn't have a booming leg. Robbie Gould is at the tail end of his career, who was more of an accuracy kicker, definitely wasn't that power leg, and Jake Moody has got a power leg. And Zane Gonzalez, to me, he's not a bad kicker either. And Matt, maybe we could just start with special teams because it's an interesting business discussion. The 49ers are carrying two kickers right now, and to me it seems like the whole strategy is a no-lose situation for them that I can't believe more teams didn't think of. They traded for Zane Gonzalez, but they spent peanuts for that and essentially nothing. It's a pick swap in the seventh round, and that swap only happens if Zane makes the 53-man roster. So it's a no-lose situation. But what they have in Zane Gonzalez is an asset, and it's a disposable asset now that they've drafted Jake Moody. But you don't have to do anything with Zane Gonzalez right now. You can wait until a team gets desperate for a kicker, right? And if that's the case, then you're going to be able to maybe sell on Zane Gonzalez for, who cares if it's only a sixth-round pick? It's still a sixth-round pick that essentially came up out of thin air that you didn't have before.
Yeah, and the only reason that Zane Gonzalez is not a starting kicker is that he's got an injury issue. or he's had a history of injuries, and that's kind of hurt his career. But I mean, if he's healthy, if the 49ers are having a quote unquote kicker competition, and he shows up well in the preseason, you know, that's going to reassure some teams that he'd be a good guy to bring in, because he is good. He doesn't he's known for his big leg. His leg has not seemed to be as big, at least on the field goal attempts, as Jake Moody so far. But yeah, I totally see that. I mean, just look at the kicker situation. The mere reason the 49ers used a third rounder on Moody is because there were an abnormal number of teams looking for a kicker during the draft, six or seven. Three were actually drafted. So you can kind of surmise that there are still some teams out there that are looking to augment their kicker situation with a young guy, and that's what Zane Gonzalez is. So yeah, for sure, that's a possibility. I'm sure the 49ers would like to get through the summer as healthy as possible, because that allows you to keep two kickers on the roster. You don't need that roster spot for another space. But yeah, that's looking to be a strength this year. Year two, Brian Schneider, you've got some sort of standout special teamers on the team, maybe even Jack Coletto, who's probably the only undrafted guy with a great shot to make the 53-man squad. He becomes part of that group, but you do see the makings of perhaps a much better special teams unit than we've seen in recent years, and that would be good, because the 49ers got better last year, but they hadn't been very good in that regard for a while, and that plays right into having a great defense. If you've got a great defense plus a great special teams, I feel like that only makes your defense that much more potent.
Absolutely. That's a formula that we've seen the 49ers ride to great success in the past. Probably that combination of great defense and special teams they haven't had since, 2011, the Jim Harbaugh team. That was a mediocre offense, right? But the defense and the special teams, both superb. And, it's not that we're saying that the 49ers offense is going to be bad this year. They finished up on a roll last season after they picked up Christian McCaffrey. So this is an opportunity for the 49ers to really field a true three-way juggernaut this year. If their special teams can be a top unit. And listen, over the final, 10 games or so, including the playoffs last year, the 49ers were a top five team in all three facets of the game. McCaffrey helped push that offense to number one. The defense blossomed back into the number one unit after a couple, I wouldn't say down years relative to the rest of the league, but relative to the 2019 performance. The defense wasn't as good in 2020 and 2021, but it roared back with a vengeance in 2022. And the special teams unit found a way to be better toward the end of the season. And I think a lot of that was Brian Schneider's coaching. I thought that they improved in the coaching department. He fielded a lot of good special teams units over a decade in Seattle. And I thought we saw the 49ers' emphasis on special teams and free agency last year end up paying off on the field. And there was another emphasis on special teams this year in both free agency and through the draft. And it was almost an emphasis by necessity, right? Because the 49ers had to sign players that they thought had a chance to make an already stacked roster. And the way to do that is to say, okay, well, can this guy play special teams? So it's just kind of a natural focus that's happened on this phase of the game, Matt. With the offense and the defense already loaded with talent, they've naturally tried to acquire players who will fit into special teams. And if they can do that, then this could be a really, really balanced team.
This discussion meshes nicely with one of our questions here. It's from Stephanie S., and I suspect this is Steph Sanchez, who we both follow on Twitter. She asks, what's your guys' perspective on Matt Maiocco's belief, shared on KNBR, that he doesn't see any of the UDFAs, undrafted rookies, or late-round picks making the 53-man squad? I had some hopes for Braden Willis and Ronnie Bell. I think special teams is a big part of that. I don't know if Maiocco is including sixth round, I assume he is. But, I mean, this is a team that likes to keep a lot of linebackers on the 53-man roster because linebackers are good on special teams and good on the coverage units. So somebody like D. Winters or Jalen Graham makes an impression. I can definitely see them beating out Demetrius Flanagan Fowles or I'm drawing a blank on the Curtis Robinson, who was on the 53 man for a big chunk of last year. Those guys were on the 53 man because they were really valuable on special teams. So one of those linebackers would have to sort of prove that. But we've seen that. I mean, we saw Jordan Mason do that last year. Jordan Mason was undrafted, really kind of dedicated himself, very clever, very smart tack that he took to learning special teams, something he didn't do at Georgia Tech, became very valuable at that spot, and then used that to sort of parlay himself into a an offensive role. So, I mean, we're going to have to wait and see, but I think that those two guys certainly have a shot. And I mentioned Jack Coletto. He just gives you a lot of bang for your buck. He can fill in a lot of spots. And if he is as outstanding on special teams as Schneider thinks he's going to be, yeah, I think he's got a really great shot of making the 53-man squad. David, what do you think?
Well, I think, first of all, we can't undersell the fact that due to all the rules changes that we've seen in recent years, that it's not just the 53-man roster. It really is the 70-man roster now as far as game day effectiveness goes. I mean, we've seen the 49ers utilize that practice squad very efficiently in recent years. So just because somebody doesn't make the 53 definitely doesn't mean that we won't hear from them, right? This is a situation where the 49ers treat this as a living, expandable roster with that practice squad included. And you have to have it because 53 won't get you through a season. So, you know, maybe somebody like Braden Willis doesn't make the 53. I currently have him projected to make it. I currently have Ronnie Bell projected to make it. I currently have Jack Coletto on the outside looking in, but I think that they'll be able to bring him back to the practice squad. And if they decide that that's too risky, maybe they do keep him on the 53. But either way, I think that we can't view that line at 53 as this hard line that can't be crossed, because that's definitely not how the 49ers have operated. As far as those late-round guys go, I know for a fact that the 49ers were very, very pleasantly surprised that Braden Willis was still available in the seventh round. I think they value him as much higher than a seventh round pick, but that they were able to get him there. So they got that value in somebody like Braden Willis, who's one of the top yak guys at tight end, who is already a mean blocker. Both characteristics, by the way, that I think can translate into success on special teams. Ronnie Bell's got that return ability. That can be valuable for the 49ers, make him more versatile to make the roster. So we'll see in training camp, but my projection right now, and I keep that little spreadsheet of the projection, I have both of those guys on the inside. I have Braden Willis as the fourth tight end, and I have Ronnie Bell as the 49ers' sixth wide receiver. So we'll see how that pans out. But in my opinion, Matt, even if they don't make it, it's not the end of their 49ers story, because they have utilized that practice squad with really, really good efficiency over the past several years.
Right, and we should note that, you know, the rules are such that guys from the practice squad can be brought up on game days, so it's a blurry line sometimes between practice squad and 53-man squad. Sometimes practice squatters can end up playing quite a bit during the season. Frank D. has a question. He says, injuries are always a concern. Which unit do you fear is most thin? Which do you think is deepest? David, do you have any thoughts on that?
I think that the offensive line still has to prove itself in terms of depth, and I would like to see more cornerback depth if I'm John Lynch for the 49ers. And they might have the tools and the raw materials there to be a team that's deep enough, but I think that we need to see that from some of these players. So along the O-line, you've got your starting five set, right? Williams, Banks, Brendel, Burford, McKivitz. That's essentially set, let's put it that way. But beyond that, you know, I have John Feliciano is a lock to make the roster. He's going to be your top backup along the interior line, left guard, center, right guard. I don't think anybody else is a firm 100% lock. I know they really like Matt Pryor. Sure, very likely to make the roster as your swing tackle. But I think Jalen Moore is going to have something to say about that, or at least a chance to say something about that during training camp. I want to see where Leroy Watson is, who, you know, he was a tight end a couple years ago. Spencer Burford's teammate in college. He's put on a lot of weight. He looks the part now, but can he be a guy that makes the 53-man roster and is actual legitimate, capable depth for the 49ers at tackle? And then, you know, who else is going to step up and be an interior backup? Because you don't want to leave it only to John Feliciano. So is Nick Zakel ready to make that second-year stride? Is somebody like Jason Poe ready to crack that 53-man roster? Joey Fisher, the undrafted rookie out of Shepherd, who got all of that signing bonus money from the 49ers, is an undrafted free agent, I think like $130,000 or $140,000. There's a lot of raw material here to work with, a lot of moldable clay, if you will, but who's actually going to get molded? Who's going to be that depth for the 49ers? And then I can never skip the cornerback position in these discussions, because the 49ers were burnt by lack of cornerback depth in 2021. And now I look at it and I see two capable starters in Charvarius Ward and Diomedo Lenore. But beyond that, I'm, you know, really skeptical still, because somebody like Ambry Thomas, I've got to see it to believe it, because I didn't see it in 2022. I saw a good trajectory in 2021, obviously didn't see it in 2022. Darrell Luter Jr., he's a rookie, right? So he obviously has something to prove to show that he can be a nice depth piece for the 49ers. I thought that Deshaun Jameson had a really nice offseason program. He's a 5'9 DB out of Texas. We talk about special teams adaptability. He had an electric return reel at Texas, so maybe he can punch a ticket onto the 70-man roster at least with that. But maybe he is a depth piece. I don't know. They've got a lot of guys, Matt, but the guys aren't necessarily proven beyond the top two and Ward and Diomedo Lenore.
Yeah, I would pick cornerback as well. And it's really just Ward who's got the experience there. So if this team were to lose Ward, you'd be looking at Diomedo Lenore, who until late December, it might have even been January, people were very down on, giving up big plays, big downfield plays, and he identified that as his biggest area of focus. Tracking the ball in the air, being able to, and this seems so simple for somebody who's played sports all of his life. Why are you having trouble tracking the ball on those deep throws? Well, you got to keep track of the guy that you're covering too, and your back is to the ball. I think it's a lot more difficult than maybe we think it is. But that's where his focus is this offseason. I think he's on the right path. I like him because he's just so gritty, and he's got a quiet confidence about him. He doesn't seem to go in the dumps when bad things happen, which is kind of a common thing for cornerbacks. So I'd say that is the thinnest spot, and then the deepest I would say is defensive line. It's just a lot of names there. Maybe only three stars in that defensive end spot opposite Nick Bosa. It'll be fun to watch Cleveland Farrell look good in that last mini camp practice. I think he's ultimately going to be the starter there, as Drake Jackson, who got a lot of attention this spring, continues his maturation. I just can't envision the light going up on quite that quickly for Drake Jackson. I think it will. But I think as the season begins, it's going to be a little bit slower. Let's see. One more question. We got one from Fabian V. He says, do you believe Debo saying he's going to have a great season has merit, or is it just talk? Your training camp reports did not sound promising. I think Fabian's referring to our training camp reports that Debo wasn't practicing, and he's right. I mean, that there's a big distinction between what he did and what we saw Christian McCaffrey and Brandon Ayuk doing. These guys seemed ready. They seemed eager to really work on their skills and sort of put themselves in a position to have a great training camp. Deebo Samuel didn't have that, but it sounds like he had a true, legitimate kind of slap in the face moment when he met with Kyle Shanahan and they went over his 2022 tape, and neither guy liked what they were seeing on film. Deebo Samuel has a lot of pride. And when he gets upset, he plays really well. So it sounds like he's going to take these 40 days or whatever it is before training camp begins and really get himself to a point where he takes off at the start of training camp. So that's going to be something to watch. In 2021, Deebo Samuel was far and away the best receiver in training camp. In 2022, Brandon Ayuk was far and away the best receiver in training camp, and their ensuing seasons showed that. In 2023, both of these guys seem like they're really motivated, it's going to be interesting to see when training camp ends who look like the better guy, because like I said, when those guys are prepared and when they're motivated, it shows on the field.
Yeah, in 2021, I still remember the talk at training camp. The 49ers were calling Deebo Samuel Skinny Deebo because he was just in such good shape at camp, and he was catching deep passes, short passes, everything. And then he really started to punish opponents during the regular season. You can't really see that aspect of his game at camp practices because they're nowhere near as physical as actual games. But boy, once that regular season started, I remember the game against Seattle. They're down by 2 touchdowns late. They lost. It was week 4. Trey Lance came in there in the second half. Samuel, there was a touchdown from about the 10 where he caught the screen pass and just bowled over 4 people into the end zone. And it was all, like a 6 touchdown in 4 games at the start of the season. And everybody was like, wow, you know, this is real. And that continued through the whole year. There were times in the 49ers just absolutely leaned on him. So as Deebo starts, so Deebo goes. It seems that whenever he comes in a little bit out of shape, or, you know, there's something that puts him behind the eight ball as far as conditioning goes, as was the case in 2020 when he fractured his foot in the offseason, that really carries with him for the whole year. In 2020, he had the hamstring issue that he directly linked to the broken foot in the offseason, and it wasn't good. But in 2021, when he was in shape from day one of training camp, it seemed to yield really fruitful results. So, you just have to take Deebo's word for it right now. I don't think that he's ever gone back on his word. As Matt said, when he's been motivated, it has shown, and he has had an all-pro kind of season. So it seems that he's motivated after that meeting with Kyle Shanahan, and I would pay a close eye to what he looks like at training camp, because that's probably going to be a bellwether for what he looks like during the regular season.
One more on the wide receiver topic. Sterling B., which I think is Sterling Bennett, asks, what did you make of Danny Gray's OTAs minicamp? After having practically no impact on last season, how do you feel about his spot among the wide receivers' depth chart? I will say that he was inconsistent. There were a lot of drops, David, in the spring. Juwan Jennings had a bunch, and he tends to have a lot of drops in practices. I remember that happening last year, and you don't see that in the game. So that may be a kind of practice versus game day duality about Jennings. Danny Gray, though, you know, got a lot of reps, and I think that was good. I mean, I think that's a real positive. No Deebo Samuel meant that Danny Gray got a lot of work with all the QBs, including whoever was the top QB that day. And he made some plays. The speed is obvious. It's obvious that the 49ers want to use him. You know, this is a running team. This is a team that is going to lean on Christian McCaffrey a lot, and they love the idea of catching defenses cheating by sending Danny Gray deep and hitting him on a back-breaking play. So, I mean, he's valuable in that regard, and that's why I think that he's ultimately going to make the 53-man squad. He's probably going to be in the same spot, basically that fourth wide receiver that he was last year. But, you know, he also slipped a few times, and Like I said, had a few drops. I wrote that the light hasn't gone on all the way for him yet. It's blinking right now, but you're starting to see signs that he's moving in the right direction. I guess that's the most positive way that that you can put it. What did you think about Danny Gray?
I think that's a fair assessment, and that's what he needed to show during OTAs, right? He needed to show signs of moving in the right direction, and now he's going to have to really show it during training camp. We're still really early in this process for some of these guys who might end up being bubble players for the 49ers. You know, I see it as Kyle Shanahan definitely wants a burner. He historically has liked the burner on this receiving core in the past. They had Marquise Goodwin, then Travis Benjamin came in, and I think he wants Danny Gray to play that role. They signed Chris Conley, the 30-year-old veteran, who's a straight-line burner as well. But Conley is on a one-year contract, and Gray's a third-round pick, and you still have him under team control for three more seasons. It's just way more beneficial for the 49ers to develop Gray and see him become, you know, that the owner of that burner role in this 49ers offense. So as long as he keeps on progressing, I think there's a natural bias from the 49ers to have him take that spot, if you will. And we'll know more in training camp. But I do agree, it was up and down during OTAs. I do think he had more of a presence than we ever saw last year, which you would hope for and you'd expect from a second-year man, especially a second-year receiver in Shanahan's system. A lot of these first-year receivers, it's easy to kind of not have that body language, not have that presence that you'd want because you're Shanahan's so particular with players in that position, and you don't quite have that body language. You don't quite have, you know, that just you're not commanding the respect that you would want a receiver to command. But in that second year, you want to see that receiver start to take those strides, and we'll see if that ends up being the case for Danny Gray.
Yeah, you might even look at Danny Gray and Ronnie Bell as sort of opposites in a lot of ways. Like Bell played a lot at Michigan. He was in on a lot of big plays. The 49ers had a lot of confidence that he's going to pick up the offense quickly and could have a role on this team. What he lacks is really kind of big-time physical skills. And that's where Danny Gray obviously excels. He's the fastest guy on the team. But I remember talking to his SMU coaches last year, and even them, I mean, these are like his parents almost. I mean, these are people that are, you know, love the guy and have invested in the guy. And as fawning as they were about Danny Gray, they realized that he was still a work in progress, even as he was leaving SMU. And that it might take a little while for that light to fully come on. So I think the 49ers understand that. They're going to give him some rope. Your point about his presence, I think, is a good one, because that was palpable out there. He was one of the guys that they were looking to. He didn't always come through like Brandon Ayuk did, but he's on his way. Let's try the stage cue. I think we've got one person here. This isn't always great, but we'll see if it works. We got Josh M. Josh, you are queued up if you are still on the line. Hello, Josh M.
Hey, Matt, can you hear me?
Got you.
I can hear you. Perfect.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, guys, and thanks for doing this. It's always a lot of fun. Love all the, you know, real-time updates and keeping us in the know. I'm curious, you know, speaking on the lines of depth, I'm really curious about the backup tight end position. You guys had mentioned briefly Braden Willis earlier and all the excitement around him. I'm really curious about the other guy, Cameron Latu. I'm actually really low-key excited about his potential after reading a little bit about what Scott McLuhan had to say. Was just curious if he's carrying himself confidently and if he looks smooth and if you're seeing some of those basketball skills translate out there.
Well, Matt has a big piece coming out on Cam Latu that I'm excited to read. So, Matt, why don't you take this one?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the two words that Brian Fleury, the tight ends coach, used to describe Cam Latu is raw power. And I think that sums it up really nicely because he's raw. This is the guy who went to Alabama fully intending to be a pass rusher and then kind of switched midstream to tight end. So Fleury was saying to me that Yeah, Cam Latu is not quite as advanced as some other rookie tight ends are entering the NFL. But what they like is the power side. And you heard George Kittle say this the other day. This is something a lot of people say. He was bigger than I expected him to be. And he's a very, very strong, powerful guy in that he's got all the raw materials to be, the inline blocker that they need to complement George Kittle. A guy who can move not just linebackers, but defensive linemen. He has an innate strength about him. What Fleury's job is going to be is to kind of teach him all the details to kind of use that strength most effectively. And that's the question with any rookie. How quickly can he pick it up to be at an NFL level? But I think everybody was very impressed by him. Trey Lance's nicest pass. Oh, I guess it was. No, I'm sorry. It wasn't Trey Lance. Trey Lance threw a nice pass, downfield pass in 7-on-7s on Wednesday to George Kittle. Sam Darnold's nicest pass of the day was a deep ball to Cam Latu. And it was deep. I mean, we're talking, it probably would have been a 50 plus yard touchdown. He got ahead of Horn Burks. That's something that you didn't see a lot in the Alabama tape. I think the 49ers believe that this is a guy that was starting to kind of show what he could do at Alabama, and there's a lot more left in him. The question for 2023, I think, is, how quickly can he kind of pick that up? And I get the impression, talking to Latu, that it wasn't just the kind of the technique and things like that that he was lacking when he first converted to tight end at Alabama. There was a confidence issue too. He just didn't know if he could do it. He'd never done it before. And here he was at Alabama, of all places, and having to deliver. And I got the distinct impression that his confidence in himself at that position was still growing as he was leaving Alabama. So I think that's a big part of it too. So when he makes a big play, in practice like that, I think that's a really, really big thing. But I'm sort of a lot more impressed and sort of excited about him today, Josh, than I was when they drafted him in late April.
That's great. Thanks, Matt.
Thanks for the question. Let me scan a little bit for another one, David. Okay. All right. Here's a defensive side of the ball question for you, David. This is one I get a lot. And we just seen Frank Clark sign with the team. A couple of other pass rushers sign as the spring sessions come to a close. Joseph B. asks, "What do you think the 49? Do you think the 49ers will make a push for Ngakoue?" Yannick Ngakoue, who really kind of fits a lot of what the 49ers do at that defensive end spot opposite Nick Bosa.
Well, I really think it comes down to price. They've armed themselves with the ability to do it with some of the restructures, the latest one being the Christian McCaffrey restructure. But you have to remember that unused cap room carries over to the next season. And when you look at the 49ers' finances for 2024, this is where it starts to get tricky, where and right now they have to be thinking about every million, a million here, a million there. That's what's going to ultimately determine if they can keep this team together, at least the core of the team together, and surf that wave of the growing salary cap moving forward into 2024 and beyond. So they have more liabilities right now in 2024 than the cap is even expected to be, right? We don't know exactly what it will be, but they're over. They're going to have to figure out a way to get creative and get under. One way that would really help is to carry over some unused room from this season into next. So that's why I say it depends on the cost. You saw Frank Clark sign the other day with Denver for, I believe, something around $7 to $8 million a year. That's steep. I look at anything over $3 or $4 million a year to be a little expensive for the 49ers' tastes right now. Now, if Yannick Ngakoue is guaranteed to give you 10 sacks. And, you know, of course you start thinking somewhere between 5 and 10 million might be worth it for this season. But I think at this point, the 49ers are showing a lot of faith in Drake Jackson. He's put on a lot of muscle. Nick Bosa said that he's just as fast, even with that added bulk. And that's a very cost-effective option. If you're going to go to one of these veteran edge rushers, then they're going to want a lot of money. And any, you know, I liken the salary cap and keeping a team together to a sink that is filling up with water. And at some point, you know, you could, that sink is going to overfill and that water is going to start spilling out. That's you having to cut players. Yeah, I don't know exactly where that point is. The 49ers probably don't know exactly where that point is until they know what the salary cap next year is. But we do know that teams in the past have hit that point. The 49ers did in the 90s. The Rams hit it this offseason. They had to let go of some good players. So you don't want to look up in the mirror and realize that your sink is overflowing because at that point it's too late and you can't sustainably keep the team together. So that's why they have to tap dance really, really carefully here. At this edge rusher position, they're in a good financial spot right now, but any more that they spend could threaten, you know, what happens in the future. And if they can get Ngakoue, if they can get Justin Houston at a really cost efficient deal, hell yes, I think they're going to go for it. But right now they're probing the waters. They're holding out. They're playing a little stare contest right now because they don't want to blink too soon. They want to make sure that they stay on the correct side financially of things.
Yeah, that's my thought too. I mean, they've got my interpretation of what they've done is that they think that the combination of Cleveland Farrell plus Drake Jackson this year is going to, you know, they also have Austin Bryant at that spot. Those three will sort of stem the tide, and I think that their future thought is that Robert Beal is your Ngakoue, sort of your speed rusher, the guy that just kind of bursts off the snap, runs that arc to the quarterback really well, and that the future at defensive end is a triad. It's Nick Bosa and Drake Jackson and Robert Beal. This is sort of the bridge year, and the bridges are Austin Bryant and Cleveland Farrell. So I think that's what the 49ers want to have happen. I think Farrell kind of showed some things in that Wednesday practice that were positive. Not much you can take away from O-line, D-line in the spring. But I think that's what the 49ers' plan is. Speaking of O-line, D-line, Mark H. asks, how is Colton McKivitz doing? Any updates on his offseason? To be honest, I didn't notice McKivitz much, which I guess is positive. As I was just alluding to, the first OTAs we watched, the offensive line didn't even participate, really. They just kind of stuck to themselves the whole time. And then they were kind of slowly but surely added into the mix as practices got on and they cranked things up. So there certainly wasn't any one-on-one stuff where it's Farrell going up against McKivitz. Not a lot to really kind of analyze with the O-line, the D-line, really the running game in general. Jack Coletto was busy on special teams. He didn't get in much on offense. So those positions are very hard to analyze. I can tell you that the 49ers think that that McKivitz is going to be a definite drop off from Mike McGlinchey as far as run blocking. But they also think that he could be better at pass protection than McGlinchey was. So the aggregate is that, it may not be as dramatic a change as we're thinking. I think McKivitz really kind of instills a lot of confidence in them because of his personality. He's a guy that, you know, gets along with everybody. He's friendly. He's just not phased by much. McGlinchey kind of famously got inside his own head whenever he would make a mistake. He wanted so much to be reliable. He wanted to be the guy, Mr. Responsibility, nickname was CEO, that he put too much pressure on himself. and would kind of go into the tank. They're not worried about McKivitz in that regard, which I think is, you know, great for any position, especially one that can be kind of scrutinized like the tackle position. David, what are your thoughts on Colton McKivitz?
I think you hit the nail on the head when you talk about the potential improvement in pass protection, or that might be what the 49ers need to get to the next level. You know, pass protection on the right side of the line has been an issue for this team throughout the entire Shanahan-Lynch era. It was a huge problem in the Super Bowl against the Chiefs. That was when Mike Person was dealing with a neck injury and really struggling there on the right side. Obviously, McGlinchey is through those first 3 years, McGlinchey was a below average pass protector. He got better over the past two seasons, but it was still an issue against some of the stronger edge rushers like Michael Parsons of the Cowboys. And the 49ers offense really did start to see some issues in the playoffs that it didn't see during the regular season. And you look at these teams that have won the Super Bowl recently, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers at the end of that 2020 season, that was just a rigid offensive line. Last year, the Kansas City Chiefs, they invested so much in the O-line, specifically in pass protection, and they were able to stonewall the Eagles. I think the 49ers have gotten a lot better in pass protection. The metrics say they were a top 10 pass protecting unit in each of the past two regular seasons, but I think they still needed a little bit of a push forward, especially against playoff competition. And if you look 1 through 5 at the offensive line, Trent Williams is obviously good enough. Aaron Banks should make a second-year jump. I mean, that's what you're counting on if you're the 49ers. Same thing with Jake Brendel at center. Same thing with Spencer Burford at right guard. So that leaves that right tackle position. How are you going to improve there? Well, you could change players there, and that's what they did. And they have acknowledged that the run blocking is going to go downhill because Mike McGlinchey was so good at that. But it won't take all that much to be better than Mike McGlinchey at pass protection, even a better version of Mike McGlinchey, because he was a lighter, more athletic guard that wasn't a tackle that wasn't as good at anchoring. And in the very small sample that we saw from Colton McKivitz last year, he gave up hardly anything. I think it was 40 to 50 snaps, and it was against the Rams. Most of that was against the Rams, too, and he was really, really good. And the 49ers are very confident that he could perpetuate that over a longer stretch. And if he does, that might be the missing ingredient for this offensive line, Matt.
One last question, and then David and I will wrap up. This is from Linda H. Thoughts on Jair Brown? Do we use more three safety looks?
Absolutely, they're going to use more three safety looks. That's in the plans. And you know what's really interesting to me, Matt, is look what they did with Nickelback, with Isaiah Oliver. He is not built like your Nickelbacks of the past. You know, Kaywan Williams was 5'9", 170. Isaiah Oliver is 6 feet, over 200 pounds, which immediately shows me that they want a nickelback who's interchangeable with a linebacker role. And I think as far as the safeties go, they've run three safety sets before. They broke Talanoa Hufanga in 2021 when running three safety sets. But the key for any three safety set is positional interchangeability, because sometimes you're going to want that third safety to be more of a linebacker. Sometimes you're going to want him to be more of a high post safety. Sometimes you're going to want him to be more of a big nickel. Sometimes even an edge rusher if you want to line up close to the line and bring extra pressure to the quarterback. When Daniel Bullocks was saying that we think Jair Brown has our DNA the other day, he meant that Jair Brown can wear all of those different hats. And it's going to be so important for Brown to be able to wear those different hats, because that's what's going to be able to get him onto the field as the third safety. And the reason I brought up Isaiah Oliver earlier is that I think this is a bigger plan of interchangeability for the 49ers. They want that nickel to not just be able to cover small slot receivers. They want him to be able to cover tight ends, to be able to deal with the run game. And I think they're going to want the same thing out of Jair Brown. I think they're very impressed with him so far, and I think they've earmarked that third safety slot for him, because the way that Tashaun Gibson and Talanoa Hufanga played together last year, I think they had 9 interceptions between the two of them. You don't want to take one of those guys off the field until you absolutely have to. So three safeties, that's the answer for the 49ers to be able to maximize the talent that they currently have on the roster.
And two of those safeties, Hufanga and Brown, are big guys and rough and tumble guys who, are not a far cry from being linebackers. So They ought to be able to kind of handle any of that close to the line of scrimmage stuff that anyone throws at them. Well, this has been good. David, I wanted you to talk a little bit about a really good story, really interesting story. Sort of jealous that you got this story because I think it's really a fantastic one and speaks to who this person is. But you've got a good Christian McCaffrey story on the horizon. Do you want to preview that a little bit?
Yeah. So this happened last week, last weekend, last Saturday. So almost a week ago now at this point, Christian McCaffrey hosted a Madden tournament. It's called the Logan Bowl. He hosted it at the 49ers facility, but only Fred Warner out of the participants was there. It was a bunch of other NFL stars elsewhere. Fred Warner actually ended up winning the tournament. It raised a bunch of money for what the Christian McCaffrey Foundation has named the Logan Project. So you're wondering who Logan is. Well, Logan was a 13-year-old boy who passed away due to leukemia a few years ago, who was a massive Christian McCaffrey fan. And one of his wishes while he was in the hospital was, you know, because he was in the hospital during the whole COVID era when the isolation was especially bad. One of his wishes was he wanted to start, and it wasn't just a wish. This young boy was actually trying to work on this himself. He was trying to get hospitals set up with gaming systems for young patients so that these patients would be able to stay in contact with their friends and maybe lift their spirits up while they're in the hospital. And, unfortunately he passed away. He was working on this at the time of his death. Big Christian McCaffrey fan. He was even buried in Christian McCaffrey's jersey. There's a lot more that I get into in the story. There was a real connection between him and Christian. Anyway, Christian McCaffrey obviously took notice of all this and decided to perpetuate the efforts of Logan Hale. So that's what I wrote about. Christian McCaffrey doing a lot of really, really good stuff off the field. I think a lot of times you see some of these charitable efforts and I'm not saying they're bad, but it's usually just a player, you know, attaching his name to something and, you know, on everybody goes with their day. But Christian McCaffrey has been very, very personally involved with this. And once you, I think, read this story and read some of the details behind it and his connection with Logan, you'll probably be able to understand a little bit more as to why.
Yeah, it seems to have really kind of struck a true chord with him. And it's a great idea that he had. I mean, what a way for a child who's kind of isolated in a hospital room to be able to interact and compete and have fun. Sounds like a truly wonderful idea that Christian McCaffrey is going to help perpetuate from here on out. It's terrific. Well, we look forward to reading that. If there's some BOSA news this summer, David and I will have another chat like this at some point, but for now, we will be signing off. David is going to be leaving the country for a big trip with his new wife. Very excited about that. Excited to hear your tales from abroad, and we'll get into all that when you get back, David.
Yeah, we're heading out to Africa, going to go to Tanzania, Zanzibar, and then Dubai, which is obviously not in Africa, that's in the Middle East. So all new spots for me, and I'm sure that we'll have plenty to talk about when I get back. I think it's going to be a little hotter out in Dubai than it's going to reach in California this summer, so yeah, we'll see about that.
You better pack lots of sunscreen, I think, for the safari whatnot.
I'll be ready for training camp, though. It'll seem nice and breezy at training camp in comparison.
Well, yeah, you're used to watching hyenas and cheetahs in practices. get some real-life versions in Africa.
Yeah, there we go. There we go. All right. Well, so much fun, Matt. Thanks for hosting today's show, too, and taking those questions. I appreciate it.
Okay. Well, we'll talk to everybody soon. Have a good summer.
Bye, everybody.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets, and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.